The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. The first month of your membership is 99 cents, so sign up today by going to Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim. Thanks, Gaia.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you once again. And boy, do we have a great show for you today. Mark Anthony, he is the psychic lawyer. Now, usually those two really don't seem to go together. You'll have to listen in to find out what the story is behind the psychic lawyer, Mark Anthony. And after that, we have Dr. Roger Teal. He's going to talk to us about the joy of life. And I hope that you enjoy the show. If you enjoy it, please go rate, review, and subscribe for free on the platform of your choice. iTunes, the iPad podcast app, the iPhone podcast app, Stitcher, Google Play on Android, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, Spotify. We're in all those places. I hope that you will rate, review, and subscribe whenever and wherever possible. We thank you so much, and here is the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest today is Mark Anthony. He's been on the program a couple of times before, and we haven't caught up for a couple of years, so almost glad to talk with him. Always has interesting things to say. Mark Anthony is the psychic lawyer, and he's a practicing medium who not only communicates with spirits, but he is also a successful attorney, licensed to practice law in Florida, Washington, D.C., and before the United States Supreme Court. He graduated from Mercer Law School with honors, which included the study of law at Oxford University. Now, that's something, Oxford University, it's very impressive. He has also studied mediumship in England at the Arthur Findlay College for the Advancement of Psychic Science. He is a published author of the bestsellers Never Letting Go and Evidence of Eternity. And that book bridges the gap between the spiritual and the scientific. So we welcome the psychic lawyer, Mark Anthony. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thanks, Jim. It's always great being on your show. I always have such a good time with you. And, you know, a lot of people look at being interviewed as work, but when I get to be on a show like yours, it's fun. So,
thank you. That's very kind. Mutual here. You're always a great guest. So we haven't caught up for a couple of years on the show. So what is new in the world of Mark Anthony these days?
Well, as you know, I've got my two books, Never Letting Go and Evidence of Eternity, out. And, you know, it's funny because when you put a book out and it's out and you do the promotion for the first year, you think that, okay, well, that's it for that book. But I just found out that they're now in five different languages, Evidence of Eternity is going to be released in French in a couple months. And so now they're making another resurgence to the world, not just in English, but in Serbian, Slovak, Polish, Estonian, Romanian, Bulgarian, now French. And I don't know why my publisher doesn't seem to get, you know, let's put it in Spanish, but so that's going on. And plus, I am on a nationwide speaking tour. I've been speaking about the science behind the afterlife, and of course, doing gallery readings as a psychic medium to connect random audience members with loved ones and spirit. And so I have a lot of events coming up this year. I'm going to be speaking at the Life in the Afterlife Conference in Phoenix in September, the International Association Near-Death Studies in Denver in August. I'm going to be at the Edgar Cayce Center talking about at the Reincarnation Summit in May. I've got events at Unity of Naples coming up actually this week, and then other events in Florida, in Fort Lauderdale, in Texas. Looks like I'll be in Minneapolis in June. So I'm busy. I love what I do. You know, I could do without the airports and the public transportation aspect of traveling, but I sure do. I know once you get through all of that. And I want to thank the TSA for doing such a great job, and the airlines and everybody else. As a friend of mine once said, I hate to travel, but I love going places.
Yeah, so. Yeah. It's unfortunate that you have to travel to get there. Now, in terms of your story, I know you've been on the show before, but just to briefly recap, I mean, how does one go from studying law at Oxford, you know, one of the world's great universities, and getting a license to practice even in front of the United States Supreme Court, and then end up a psychic? Can you give us the brief recap on that?
Yeah, it's a very very good question, but it's actually kind of the opposite. I was born a psychic, and in my book Evidence of Eternity, I write about the genetic basis for psychic activity, because it appears to be an inherited trait. Because in my first book, Never Letting Go, I was talking about people on both sides of my family for generations. And then when I was on the Never Letting Go tour, people were asking me more and more about that. So I started studying genetics. And there's a lot of scientists who study people who are psychics and mediums. And it appears to be a genetically inherited trait, which is not an unusual thing, because a lot of there's a reason that you look like your parents. There's a reason that left-handedness runs in families or twins. Certain diseases run in families. I know this one family that it's almost a given that you're going to get Alzheimer's, and this appears to be a genetic proclivity. Also, high levels of intelligence, athletic prowess run in families as well. And so around age 4, I started seeing the spirits and talking to you can call them ghosts, but I call them spirits. And my parents understood what was going on. So they said that, you know, you can talk about it to us, just, you know, keep it in the house because people won't understand. So it was always there, Jim. It was always kind of a backdrop to my life. It gave me some insights and intuition and things. And I was always drawn toward the spiritual. I was raised Catholic and wanted to go into the priesthood until I hit puberty. And I was like, yeah, I don't want to do that. with all due respect to my colleagues in the Catholic Church, but I take a much broader view of God. I don't think that any one religion has it right, not even close. I don't understand God. In other words, I know that there's a God, but God being an infinite thing, I have insights, but I don't have all the answers. I don't believe anyone does. And so I thought there'd be too many rules and regulations being a priest, so I went to law school. Not that there's lots of rules and regulations in the legal profession. So that's kind of the skinny, the Cliff Notes version on how I ended up in these careers. And both careers are about evidence. As a lawyer, you have to have evidence, and to prove your case. As a psychic medium, you can't just go around saying, you know, your grandmother loved you and, oh, she baked cookies. I mean, everybody's grandmother baked cookies pretty much, and right. Everybody's grandmother loves them, but you've got to start producing verifiable pieces of evidence that can validate who the spirit is and the authenticity of the communication. And that's where I take my training in the field of law and apply it to spirit communication, because I'm the toughest critic of what's happening in a reading. You know, I'm not just happy, oh, he loves you, okay, or he forgives you. There needs to be a basis for why this particular spirit feels it necessary to communicate or to convey a particular piece of information. So that's why I approach spirit communication with reverence, but also I understand that it is not just spiritual, but there's also a scientific basis behind the reality of spirit communication.
So I'm guessing it would be fair to call you an evidential medium. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's got to be based on evidence.
So let's ask it. Let's take it a step further. What is and maybe if somebody's working with someone else who claims to be an evidential medium, what, in your view, and it's interesting to get your perspective as a lawyer, what is an example of a good piece of evidence or something that you can come across with that will provide that validation as opposed to these general things, you know, so-and-so is very proud of you. So-and-so is, you know, loves you, which is very common and kind of easy to say. What are some good examples of maybe some things that you've come across with for different clients?
I'm so glad. I'm laughing because I'm thinking of all these examples, and this one just always. Well, there's two of them that always crack me up, and well, actually, there's about 30 or 40 that always crack me up. But I'll tell you this one. So I'm doing a reading for this lady, and it's over the phone. So I love it when people go, "You're cold reading. You're reading their body language over the phone." Really? Okay. You know, because I'm sitting on a couch in my man cave at home, and I've got my headset on, and I'm, you know, and I'm focused into the other side, and I'm talking to this woman, and her husband had died, and I described, you know, the physiological reasons that he died, and I could, you know, tell that he died of cancer, and I feel like pains and burning sensations in certain parts of my body that corresponded to where the cancer was. But then I said, "Octopus. I'm seeing an octopus." And she goes, "Oh my God," which is always a very good thing to hear when you're a medium. And I said, "What's with the octopus?" She said, "Well, we used to live in Belize some years ago, and we lived on a canal, and we'd catch lobsters, and we'd put them in this tank overlooking the canal. One morning, my husband and I came out with our cups of coffee, and an octopus had climbed up out of the canal and was grabbing some of our lobsters." She goes, "Do you think that's what he's talking about?" And I said, "Well, unless you have another octopus story, I'm kind of thinking, yeah." You know, so, I mean, of all the things you could bring up, an octopus? So if I just say, "Oh, you had a dog," well, pretty much everybody has a dog or a cat, but not too many people have an octopus story.
No, that is very unique. I love that. Now, let me turn it around the other way. You talked a little bit about how you use your legal training in terms of approaching this as a medium. Was there ever a case where you used your psychic abilities in a case, a law case?
Several times. When I first got out of law school, my initial job was I was a prosecutor. You know, and you know, when you're a young lawyer, you envision that you come galloping out of a law school on the white horse with the American flag in one hand and the Constitution in the other and how you're going to save the world. Well, then you get into the reality of the practice of law. And they put in front of you, they meaning my bosses at the prosecutor's office, a box with like 500 files in it. And I'm like, huh? And then we would start doing what's called first appearances. And first appearances, and this is in Florida, but it's pretty much in every state. When people get arrested, they have to be brought before a judge within 24 hours so the judge can review what they're charged with, what they've been arrested for, and whether or not they should have bond. And quite frankly, Jim, when you're sitting in the drunk tank all night and you come in the morning, you look pretty disheveled.
Right.
And, you know, and they bring them in and they're in the prison, you know, the jail clothes. So they all are dressed the same. And I'd be looking at them and I go, "That one's a sex offender. That one's a drug dealer. That one's a child abuser. That one." And my colleagues would be like, "How do you know that?" And so then they'd start looking at the police reports, and it became a game that before you, you know, because there's always two of us there, before you show Mark the police report, see if he can figure out what they're charged with. And like 95% of the time, I was right. And then on jury selection, I'd be able to zero in on certain people and their issues. And certainly that is part of being a good lawyer, is trusting your intuition. And in my book, Evidence of Eternity, I discuss a concept that I developed called spiritual situational awareness. Now, situational awareness, talk to any sailor, marine, soldier, police officer, firefighter, any first responder, any military personnel, any special forces personnel about situational awareness. You've got to be paying attention in a spherical pattern of everything that's going on around you, or you're going to end up dead. And with spiritual situational awareness, it goes to another dimension. Not only are you aware of what you can see and hear and perceive with your five physical senses, it's being open to the spiritual influences that are around us as well. So in Never Letting Go, my first book, I wrote about this jury selection that I was doing. And I kept getting drawn to this one woman. Now, this case, my client was, you know, he was a big bruiser guy, and he got into a fight with another big bruiser. So it was, you know, tough guy A got in a fist fight with tough guy B. And, you know, my client beat the daylights out of the other guy, so he filed charges, which, you know, is not an unusual thing in barroom brawl and fist fight cases. Generally, it's the loser that files charges. At least it was in this case. And I kept feeling... and I call her juror number 9, you know, just to give her, you know, an identification without right. revealing details sure. about her. And I kept feeling this female spirit around her that was very connected to her and this tight sensation around my throat. Well, jury selection is the phase at the beginning of the trial where the prosecution gets to ask prospective jurors question, and then the defense gets to ask the jurors questions so that we can weed out any prejudice predispositions and try to find the most fair and impartial jury. At least that's the theory. So I just kept going back to this one lady. And so I said, have you or has anyone in your family ever been the victim of a violent crime? And she looks up at me and the tears sprout from her eyes and she begins to shake. And she said, a year ago, my sister was in a foreign country when an escaped mental patient strangled her and then dismembered her body and threw her in a garbage can like she was trash. So I'm standing there in court like, oh, my God. I mean, you could hear a pin drop and I can hear my client going, dude, what are you doing? And everyone's looking at me, and all of a sudden her sister's spirit's coming through even harder and brighter, and I'm feeling the tightening around my throat, which is indicative of someone who died from an obstruction of the throat. In other words, she was strangled. And so I literally, Jim, I had a foot in both worlds. And if anyone wants to find out what happens, you're going to have to get my book, Never Letting Go.
There you go. Now, let me ask you this. How do you draw the line with something like that, though? Because in a way, I mean, I would think for your clients, it's great that you've got this extra sense about thing. It's great for you. But sometimes I would think that it almost there might be an ethical dilemma there. I mean, is there a line that you have to draw with those kind of things?
Well, you know, there's not an ethical dilemma at all because it's part of my skill set. And having a good intuitive sense is part of what makes someone, a good trial lawyer. That's like saying it's an ethical dilemma because you have an extremely wealthy client who can afford all the best, experts.
Sure, sure.
OJ. Yeah. OJ. Or you know, when let's say you get into a car accident and you're suing the person who caused the accident, you know, meaning the rules of evidence, do not allow the jury to understand that you're really not suing the person who caused the car accident because their insurance company is defending them. So if you go up against someone insured by Allstate, State Farm, Geico, Farmers, I mean, you know, you can go on and on and on. They have a war chest of, $1 million. Okay, and you're trying to sue because your client, you know, broke a few bones and, you know, got a few chipped teeth or, you know, hopefully it's, you know, only something on a minor scale. So everybody has advantages and disadvantages, and it's part of your skill set. I mean, I know some attorneys that their skill set is they are so aggressive and so mean they'd cut you in two for $50. And, you know, and they just won't take no for an answer, and they're rather insufferable people to be around. I've always been of the philosophy that you can be an effective attorney while being a gentleman or, you know, a lady, because the problem with the legal profession is it has gone from being truth, justice, and the American way to who can outmaneuver who's got more leverage, who's got more money and power.
Right.
And that's the reality of it. And if you tell me that, you know, juries and people aren't predisposed and prejudiced, then that's why we have jury selection. You know, I mean, you get an African-American defendant and there's an all-white jury, they're not going to stand as good a chance as they would if they truly are being judged by a jury of their peers. So having intuitive insights and psychic ability certainly helps, you know, but it doesn't make me all knowing and all seeing, because I can't very well go, excuse me, Your Honor, a spirit just came in and said that the person on the witness stand is lying. Okay. But I have, I got to tell this story. I don't mean to laugh, but I was trying a case and my client was just not a very physically appealing person. Okay.
Okay.
I mean, with all due respect to him, I mean, he just was, you know, he was short and heavy and he had a beard, and honestly, somebody made a remark that he looked like one of those little garden gnome statues. Okay.
Oh, and my goodness.
You know, but he was a nice guy, you know, and he had this asthmatic condition where he's like, so I had this breathing thing. I mean, you know, the poor guy, I mean, there's just, the deck was stacked against him in life in general. And he was on all these medications for his asthma, and he had been arrested for drunk driving. Okay. And, you know, he'd had a beer or two, but the tests were inconclusive. In other words, he refused the breathalyzer test. Well, the arresting officer, okay, marches into the courtroom. Oh, my God. The guy looks like Tom Cruise from Top Gun. Okay. I mean, he's got the uniform that's all starched and the big shiny badge and those angular features, movie star face. And wouldn't you believe that there's five women on the jury? Okay. It's a jury of six. There's five women and one man, and they're all looking at this guy like, ah. So obviously I got my work cut out for me, because it's the garden gnome versus Tom Cruise. And so I'm cross-examining him, and a big issue that he kept saying was how bloodshot my client's eyes were. Well, if you look at my client, I mean, he's just, you know, dripping and wheezing. I mean, I think the guy always has had bloodshot eyes. And all of a sudden, something came to me. And I said, well, there's a lot of reasons people got to have bloodshot eyes. They could be swimming and have pool chlorine in them, right? He goes, well, I suppose so. And he smiles, looks at the jury, flashing his big pearly whites. I said, it could be smoking, you know, like in a smoky environment. He goes, like in a bar? Yes, it could. And then I said, and this one spirit said, say this. I go, you ever seen someone's eyes when they were crying be bloodshot? And he looks over and goes, I've never observed anyone have bloodshot eyes from crying. And I said, are you married? And he looks at me and his face contorts. He goes, I never made her cry like that.
Oh, my.
And all of a sudden, all the women on the jury, it looks like he just stuck lemons in all their mouths. They were looking at him like, you know. It came back not guilty, Jim, in under 5 minutes.
Wow.
The jury, you know, the jury instructions that the judge reads are like 20 something minutes. They went back and they had a verdict, and I'm looking at my client and goes, oh, they're going to convict me. And they come out and go, not guilty. I mean, that did it. And so that was one of those intuitive things that came to me. And once again, that's part of being an experienced and a good attorney, is trusting your intuition. It's part of being a good cop, a good military, you know, a good soldier, good Marine. You know, you trust your feelings. You trust your intuition. And a little test that I do when I give public speaking, Jim, as I say, show of hands of all the women who feel they have women's intuition. All the women, of course, raise their hands. I go, guys, let's call it instinct. Okay, Harrison Ford, Denzel, you know, Samuel L. Jackson, right. They have instinct, you know. You know, so the guys, I go, okay, how many people are, when you overrule your instinct, are you A, happy you did it, or B, regret it? It's like 99% always say, I always regretted it. And that's part of understanding psychic phenomenon. You get an impulse, okay, and you trust it. Okay, now, when I say impulse, an impulse to pick up a knife and go stab someone because they tick you off. All right, that one you have to overrule. But I'm talking about an informational impulse, okay? What happens, though, is particularly with men, is if we start getting intuitive feelings, we begin to pick it apart. I call we cross-examine it, borrowing from my legal background, and you start picking it apart and hyperanalyzing it, and then you shoot it all to pieces. But all the, you know, I've talked to a number of like Delta Force and PJ and Navy SEALs. My dad was a Navy SEAL, and they say when you get that gut feeling, you go with it. So to an extent, we are all psychic. It's just that some people are better at it or have the physiological predisposition to be better at it.
Interesting, interesting. Our guest is Mark Anthony. He is the psychic lawyer, and we are going to get back with him right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. You know, with phones and tablets and streaming boxes like the Roku and the Apple TV and the Chromecast, we have so many ways of watching so much content. But what if you want to get the type of information we love, the type of information you love to hear on this podcast? When you want the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained, the question is, where do you go if you want a streaming TV service that values those topics? And there really is only one choice, and that choice is Gaia. Gaia explores the topics we love and is always providing viewers with tremendous new content. Now, every week I've been updating you with some of the latest shows, and this week is no exception. You know, we just had that big double episode premiere with Linda Moulton Howe and her new show called Truth Hunter. In those two episodes, she looked at revelations from alien encounters, and then whistleblowers exposed the alien agenda for Earth. We've got much more great stuff coming from Linda. And then you've got shows like Wisdom Teachings by none other than David Wilcock. This last week, he looked at galactic energy zones in the work of Dr. William Tift. Then Cosmic Disclosure, hosted also by David Wilcock and Corey Good. And they looked at the transformational power of the Great Solar Flash. We have new episodes coming from George Norrie, Beyond Belief. Starting March 1st, he's going to be talking to people like Lon Milo Duquette about Aleister Crowley. Len Buchanan, who's been a guest on Remote Viewing, Jeffrey Smith about GMOs, Nick Pope, of course, from the British Ministry of Defense, John Hogue on prophecy, and many, many more, including Regina Meredith. I got to tell you, if you love the topics we cover on these shows, you need to have Gaia. That's all there is to it. And it is a perfect time to join because the first month of your membership is only 99 cents. And you can cancel at any time. To mine the wisdom and be entertained and enlightened, just go to Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim to sign up for your first month. It's only 99 cents, not even a dollar, 99 cents. Come on, guys. The time is right. The technology's there. Learn from 5,000 years of wisdom now streaming on Gaia. History like you've never seen it. That's Gaia. Thanks, Gaia. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is Mark Anthony, the psychic lawyer. Now, Mark, when we have that intuition or instinct, or you have what you have, what are we tapping into exactly? I mean, is there anything you would point to in science? What do you think that we might be tapping into with all of this?
One of the objectives of my book, Evidence of Eternity, is to bridge the gap between the spiritual and the scientific. And since its release, I've continued my research and studies into the realm of quantum physics. And Albert Einstein said something very profound. Well, he said a lot of very profound things. He's one of my heroes. He said that there is no matter. When it comes to matter, we have it all wrong. There's just energy that vibrates at different levels. Now, he said that 100 years ago, and now what we understand, and he was one of the fathers or the founders of particle physics. A lot of psychics like to fling the word quantum physics, you know, a lot of people like to fling it around because it sounds cool, quantum, you know, Star Trek, you know, they went from photon torpedoes to quantum torpedoes, which are the, you know, upgraded versions, I guess. But what we learn in science is that everything's made of molecules. Molecules are composed of atoms. Atoms are composed of electrons, protons, and neutrons. And those particles are composed of a smaller unit referred to as quanta, which is electromagnetic energy. Ergo, quantum physics, particle physics. Now, when I say everything, Jim, I mean everything. I mean the microphone I'm talking into, the radio waves that are being shot through the atmosphere to satellites, to the air you and I are breathing, to the chairs we're sitting on, to the Earth itself, to the space between the Earth and the sun, we're talking everything is composed of electromagnetic energy and on a subatomic level of quanta, which means that everything is the same basic form of energy on the most minute level. And scientists, now physicists are saying, and Dr. Michio Kaku, and I love him. He's one of my heroes too.
Sure.
He's the American physicist of Japanese descent who is one of the founders of string theory. String theory says that there's not just a universe, but there's multiverses. In other words, other dimensions. Think of it as there's other frequencies that we live in AM radio and the other side is FM radio, both sides using energy and vibration and frequency. Just AM is at a lower rate of frequency and FM much higher. Physicists, in Germany at the Max Planck Institute, which has got to be the most serious place in the world. I mean, can you think of any
place? I would think
place?
So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what's more serious than the German Physics Institute? And one of their professors said that the brain is like a computer hard drive, and the information on it does not die when the hard drive ceases to function. It merely gets transferred. Sir Adam Penrose and Dr. Stuart Hammerhoff. Penrose is from Oxford. Hammerhoff is from University of Arizona. They entered into a joint study, and they said that consciousness derives from quantum vibrations within the brain. Long story short, our soul, okay, which I refer to as a spirit, which in psychology is referred to as the consciousness, which now in physics is referred to as quantum consciousness. The electromagnetic energy that is stored in the brain, when your body dies, it transfers. It stays coherent. In other words, your personality, when you die, you take you with you. And so think of it as when we die, we're being transferred from AM radio up to FM radio, and that our consciousness stays intact. Now, what I've seen is that the other side, the spirit realm, if you will, is a collective consciousness. Think of a drop of water as it plunges into, the ocean. Okay, that drop of water is now part of the ocean, interconnected with that. Energetically, we do the same thing. When our spirit leaves our body, we go into this vast consciousness, but we maintain our personality and our individuality. And one of the concepts that I introduced in Evidence of Eternity is the collective consciousness disconnect. In other words, you can disconnect from the collective consciousness in order to communicate with people here. So what physicists are saying is that the consciousness pre-exists the body, comes into the body, and after the body leaves. That's the same thing every great spiritual teacher from the Hindus 5,000 years ago through Buddha, Jesus, Moses, all the way up until today have been saying is that the soul pre-exists the body, comes in, and goes out. And the laws of physics, the laws, not the theories of physics, teaches that energy is neither created nor destroyed, only transferred from one form to another. So when you have someone like Michio Kaku coming out and saying eternal life does not contradict the laws of physics, now we're seeing that what heretofore scientists would reject, they're beginning to feel does exist.
Yeah. You know, that's the thing. I love when you see this merging, and it just seems to make so much sense. And so many things, the example I point out, and people listening to the shows will probably be sick of it, but is that of DNA. Just because we did not know that DNA didn't know about DNA in 1900 didn't mean it didn't exist. It just, we didn't have the time, the tools, the technology, the knowledge to understand it. And now we do. So there's so much that is unseen that we don't understand, possibly just because our science hasn't caught up with reality yet.
Well, absolutely. In 1916, Albert Einstein theorized about gravitational waves, where two black holes collide and they send a ripple of energy throughout the universe. Well, last year, the existence of gravitational waves was proven when they were detected at LIGO, the Laser Interferometal Gravitational Observatory, and they detected black holes colliding, you know, thousands of light years away. So if something that happened, all right, a light year is trillions of miles long, so thousands of light years would be, you know, trillions, quadrillions, whatever the number, you know, beyond quadrillion is, can affect us? Tell me we're not all energetically interconnected. Tell me that light, which is both particles and waves and created of quanta, which is the same energy that's floating around in our body or making our body happen, we're all energetically interconnected. And I see, you know, a lot of people in the scientific community, I saw a debate where these two scientists took on Dr. Evan Alexander and Dr. Raymond Moody, Evan Alexander having the out-of-body experience and Raymond Moody, who started near-death experience studies. And they were, oh, science this, science that. Well, that's assuming that science is a stagnant state, because science in 1900 isn't the same as science in 2017.
Right.
You know, we're constantly progressing. So for scientists to say, oh, this is a bunch of hogwash, well, now you're getting people with the gray matter of Michio Kaku. And then there's also Dr. Lanza. Okay. Now, Dr. Lanza, he is one of the foremost stem cell researchers and scientists in the world. And he's put forth this theory known as biocentrism. And biocentrism says that we tend to think of our existence as being the body, and so therefore biologically focused, but that's not the case. He said our consciousness receives, our brain receives signals the same way a cable box receives information. So if you're watching TV and your cable box goes out, does that mean the TV shows and the information that you wanted to watch have ceased to exist? No, they energetically still exist. It's just that the formatting instrument is right. No longer functioning. So when your brain ceases to exist, who and what you are does not cease to exist. You merely, that data gets transferred to another dimension. Now, I know I'm on a roll right now, but the Schwarzschild quantum lattice theory. I love this one, okay? Scientists, physicists have been studying electrons, and they noticed in clinical conditions an electron will disappear, and then it reappears in another location without going through the matter in between. And they're like, well, where is it going? And it appears to be doing what is known as a quantum leap. And I know when you and I think of quantum leap, we're probably thinking of Scott Bakula, you know, turning into Elvis or something like that. But a quantum leap is an energy transfer from one dimension to another dimension and then back again. And one of the scientists studying this said, if you're ever having one of those days where you feel like you're not all there, well, you're not, because you never are. Because part of us is always on an electromagnetic level popping to another dimension. Now, this is where great spiritual teachers like a lot of the Hindus and the Buddhists talk about we're multidimensional beings. In other words, there's more to our soul and our spirit and our consciousness than what is housed in the brain, and that we're all energetically interconnected. Okay, and you've probably heard a lot of spiritual people talk about we're all cells in the body of God. Well, if we're going back to quantum physics, where we're all at the most basic unit, electromagnetic energy, then we are all cells in the body of God, because we're all part of this huge, infinite electromagnetic energy field. And so when we physically die, the Schwarzschild quantum lattice theory then is showing us that we're not bound to this particular dimension, which I call the material world, anymore. And then we do make the quantum leap from the material world to this higher frequency that you can call the other side. And this appears to be what happens when we die. Energy is neither created nor destroyed, only transferred from one form to another. And as Albert Einstein said, we're not matter. We're just energy that vibrates at a different frequency. So when the lower, slower density of our body ceases to function, the energy that makes us alive continues on.
I think it's fascinating. I think the whole idea that there is this explanation for this, I think this is getting to some of what we're actually seeing here, at least the beginning of it. And I think it's fascinating that this work is being done. And hopefully at some point there'll be some kind of unification where science and those of us interested in all of these topics can have some common ground and say, hey, maybe something is going on, and maybe these are some of the beginning indicators of what it is. I have to ask you about one other thing, very unrelated, or maybe it's not, but I saw it on the notes of things that you've been working on. And when I heard of this, I said, I must talk to you about, because this impacted my family. I'm convinced that this killed my mother. Back in 2013, my uncle died in early April. And he had been sick, and it was kind of expected. I mean, it wasn't completely expected, but it looked like things were trending that way. 2 weeks later, my mom dies extremely unexpectedly from a heart attack. And I'm talking about broken heart syndrome. And yes. I was surprised when I saw that you had done some work in this. And I know that there is a known medical condition that I believe the Japanese discovered and so forth. But talk to us about that. I'm fascinated by that subject, because I am convinced, at least in part, that's why I lost my mom a few years back.
I have no doubt that it is why you lost your mom. And it's referred to as Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. And this came to the forefront with the death of Carrie Fisher, and the very next day her mother, Debbie Reynolds. And people were wondering, can you die from a broken heart? And the reason it's called Takotsubo cardiomyopathy is Tako is, and we talked about octopuses before, but Tako is Japanese for octopus. Subo is the trap that they catch octopi with. In other words, it looks like a jug, and Japanese fishermen put these jugs in the bottom of the ocean, and octopuses are always looking for, you know, places to hide. What happens when people are in an extreme state of emotional distress, such as the death of a loved one, and this occurs most in like over 98% of the time in women, hormones, the grief and sadness hormones, are generated, which cause the left ventricle of the heart to malfunction, and it begins to swell up, and it takes on the appearance of the Takotsubo octopus trap in Japan. Now, cardiomyopathy indicates, you know, a disruption in the heart. So it is a real condition. It is an extremely dangerous condition. It can be caused by the death of a loved one, like in the case of your mother losing, was it her brother?
It was actually my dad's brother, but the family is extremely close.
Extremely close. Parents who lose children, like Debbie Reynolds, Carrie Fisher, you see a couple that have been married for 50 years, and one of them dies, and the other one dies within a week or so. So what happens is this can even occur, Jim, in people who have very healthy, normal hearts. Because we tend to think of people that die of a heart attack, oh, well, they must have had plaque buildup,
right, and
cardiovascular disease. But what happens is the hormones that are generated by intense stress then cause the left ventricle to malfunction, and you start getting angina, which is chest pain. You start getting shortness of breath. So if you experience like a terrible breakup, or maybe even you'll lose your job or the death of a loved one, and you start having shortness of breath and chest pain, you got to get to an emergency room, to a doctor right away, because if treated right up front, it can be prevented. There are medical treatments, beta blockers and other treatments, modalities that are used to treat people that are going into heart failure, which can then cause the swelling in the left ventricle to return to a normal state. The good news about the tacosubo cardiomyopathy is that it is reversible. People can recover, make 100% recovery, and it does not appear to recur. But you got to catch it right up front, or it can and will kill you. Now, how do you prevent it? I don't know if there is a way to prevent it. In fact, people who win the lottery sometimes drop dead.
Right, and they're you would so think, excited. Oh,
they're so
excited.
Yeah,
it's
they're
stress.
So excited, like, oh my God, what do I do? You know, and it starts sending your heart into this malfunction. So whenever there's a huge traumatic or emotional event in your life, and you start having, or someone close to you starts having these symptoms, get them in. Don't wait. Okay, I mean, wouldn't you rather spend a couple hours in an ER for nothing than
absolutely
say, gee, I wish I would have. And I want to talk to the male listeners right now. Yes, broken heart syndrome tends to happen in the vast, vast majority of cases with the women. And it may have something to do with their physiology being different than ours. However, recent studies at the Medical Center in Minnesota and at University of Southern California have shown that tears of grief actually contain the chemicals, the hormones, which cause depression. Women, on the whole, I believe, are better at embracing and expressing and processing their emotions than men are. Men tend to do anything other than cry, and that is the most unhealthy thing you can do. And we have tear ducts, we have hearts, we have feelings for a reason. This doesn't mean you need to walk into your office or your place of work and start crying your eyes out. You can do it in a private location, you know, a parked car somewhere or your man cave, or go for a walk along the beach or in the woods or whatever and cry. Get it out, because it is the healthy thing to do. And this goes for the ladies too. This removes the hormones that cause depression. And that's why after a good cry, people feel relieved. There's a physiological reason for it. You feel exhausted, so there you know there's this huge release on a mental, emotional, and spiritual level. So crying is a healthy way to cope with grief. Now, if you start crying on a daily basis, well, then we might be dealing with another condition. But crying is part of the recovery process, and it's the body's way of purging these chemicals. Now, reflex tears, like, you know, you get some dust in your eye or something, you tear up, do not contain these chemicals. So this only occurs when you're crying in response to sadness and grief.
Well, and I think one glad thing that's something that hopefully we can do, aside from all the psychic information, the idea that people should be careful when they're in this stressful situation, if they've had some great loss or some great stressful event, and just be careful out there and take care of themselves. And Mark, if they want to learn more about psychically tuning in and about everything you do, how can they do that?
My website, evidenceofeternity.com, which is the same, you know, name as my book, Evidence of Eternity. And Jim, on my page, people can find out about booking a reading with me, a telephone reading or an in-person reading. Also about my tour schedule on the calendar of events. I've got a lot of great things coming up this year. I'll be at the Center for Inner Wisdom in Fort Lauderdale in March. I'll be at Body, Mind, and Soul in Houston at the end of February. Coming up this week is Unity of Naples and then Aquarian Dreams in Melbourne, Florida. I'll be speaking at conferences across the nation. And if you go to evidenceofeternity.com, you can find out about those. You can subscribe to my YouTube page, follow me on Facebook, Twitter. It's all there because and Jim, I also want to thank you for saying, you know, we've got to help people with. It's not just psychic and paranormal stuff that we're talking about today. And one of the things I like about your show is, yeah, the paranormal is fantastic and ghost hunts and understanding quantum consciousness. I mean, I love this stuff. But it's also our obligation as teachers, as counselors, if you will, to let people know that when you are suffering from a profound state of grief, that there are ways of dealing with this. And on my website, evidenceofeternity.com, there is a page called Grief Management. This is a free resource open to everyone. And it will give you coping techniques, understanding of different faiths' view of immortality, the things you should say to someone who's grieving, and the 10 things you should not say. So there's a lot of very, very useful and helpful information. I get a lot of positive feedback from that page. So that's how people can find out about that and about my books and my work and my speaking tours and my media appearances are all on my website, evidenceofeternity.com.
Mark, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure as always. I look forward to returning.
Well, I certainly hope that you enjoyed that interview with Mark Anthony, the psychic lawyer. And I always think Mark is an interesting guy. He's been on the shows before and I always enjoy catching up. Now, next up, we'll talk about the joy of life with Dr. Roger Teel. But I wanted to mention, please, 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 if you enjoy these free podcasts, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you may find them. Rate them because that gives us a little 4 or 5 star review and that catches people's eyes. But it's just as important to write a sentence or two so people can see specifically what you enjoy about the programs. And then subscribe for free because that way you'll never miss a new episode of the Paranormal Podcast. And different systems work in different ways. You know, the big Mac Daddy, Apple with iTunes and the podcast app on iPad and iPhone. Those are really the ones where if we get the subscribes and the rates and the reviews, that really moves the needle. That's how the majority of people listen. But also, if you listen on something like Stitcher or TuneIn Radio or iHeartRadio or Spotify, Google Play, the list goes on. Wherever you have the opportunity to rate and review and subscribe, I would certainly appreciate it. We thank you so much. And now we're going to talk to Dr. Roger Teel about the joy of life. You know, there's a lot of strife in the world today, but I think you will be interested in Dr. Teel's perspective. There is joy in life. In fact, the title of his book is This Life is Joy, Discovering the Spiritual Laws to Live More Powerfully, Lovingly, and Happily. And our guest is Roger Teel, and we're so glad to have him with us. He serves as a senior minister and spiritual director of the Mile High Church with more than 30,000 members and friends in Colorado. He holds a degree in psychology and religion, a doctor of divinity degree, and a doctor of religious science degree through storytelling, humor, and practical spirituality. Dr. Teel's transforming messages help empower people and lead them to their limitless potential to live dynamically. Dr. Roger Teel, welcome to the program today.
Hey, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
So when I first saw Life is Joy on the cover, I thought of the flip side of that. I've often heard the phrase, I think it's from the Buddha, life is suffering. Why do you take the viewpoint that life is joy?
Well, I take the viewpoint that life is joy because we can rise above suffering by discovering the joy that is within us. You see, the problem is that we have forgotten the essence of our being. And so we look outside ourselves for our pleasure, for our joy, for our happiness. And we get hooked on those temporary bits of pleasure that we can orchestrate in our lives and then try to keep them there and control them. But when inevitably they don't, then we feel a rush of pain and hollowness and then seek to anesthetize that and numb that through all of the addictive processes rife in our society. So as what I believe is that we have lost track of the very essence of life itself. And what the Buddha did, by the way, going back to the Buddha, is that he saw that life at the human condition level is suffering.
Okay.
And then when we place our sense of joy or expectation for joy at the level of human conditions, then we're going to suffer because we're never going to find the joy there. So when I say that this life is joy, I'm saying the essence of life itself is celebrating. Life is celebrating itself. Look at the incredible panorama of nature.
Mm-hmm.
Look at all the unique individuals and all the gifts they bring to life. And what we really learn to do after we get through the bliss of childhood where we knew our joy is we learn how to block our joy. We learn how to succumb to fear and negative self-judgments. And all of a sudden, we start suffering inwardly, and then we attract more opportunities to suffer outwardly. So I'm calling people back to a deep joy that is within them. And I'll pause here to let you get a word in edgewise, but I think it's very important. This joy is also a source of true empowerment.
So do you feel it's true kind of what we put out there is what we get back? It's kind of a karma of sorts in the sense if we tend to think positive thoughts, more positive things tend to happen to us and vice versa. Do you subscribe to that?
Absolutely. And I take it even deeper that the whole world, the phenomenal world, the material world that we're so very aware of, is really produced out of the invisible world. And even quantum science has come along to corroborate that matter emerges out of the invisible domain of possibility. They call it consciousness now, which is what some of the ancient masters called it. So it's a field of information and energy, the birthing material. And so I believe that the invisible world of our total believing, our total consciousness, is producing our experience. Now, you've got to be a bit of a detective to understand this because, let's say, for instance, a person has early on deeply conditioned themselves by accepting a belief that they're unworthy.
Mm-hmm.
That core belief of basic inadequacy will, like some plants that go crazy, like a sumac plant I once had, it will send up tendrils out of itself and appear at the surface in a number of different ways. But if you could do it, you could trace all of those life experiences back to coming out of the seed, the inner seed of an acceptance of unworthiness. Now, a whole lot of folks are calling in all manner of experiences and also eliciting all sorts of behaviors and kinds of talk that come out of a lot of deeply held belief systems that many are unaware of because they're held in the subconscious. And so the whole approach I take is how we can start to neutralize some of these hidden beliefs that are running the show in our lives and discover that life itself is whole. We as human beings are whole. We've always been worthy. We just bought into a bunch of nonsense about that. And we can recover a sense of joy that is not dependent on how much money we make or how much power we have orchestrated in our life or the things we have any of the things that we've made prerequisites for joy in the past. We can recover an authentic joy within us.
It resonates with me because I grew up kind of thinking, well, you know, I'm not the best. There are a lot of people better than me. And I think a lot of people grow up with like this negative self-talk. I'm not good enough.
Yeah.
I'm not this enough. I'm not that enough. You know,
right.
if I got an A minus, somebody else got an A. If, you know, I had this car, somebody had a car that was a little better or whatever it might be. And some of those things are probably pretty shallow to look at, but I feel like in the last few years it started to flip for me in that I'm far from spiritual enlightenment and far from a perfect person. I need a lot of work, but I do feel internally that, and I think a lot of it's because I get to do this and do something that I love. I feel much better about myself. And it seems it's almost like feeling that way seems to breed a certain amount of success. But how do we, you know, I don't even know how I did that. I think it's just the act that I'm now doing what I really want to do and have had the chance to do that for a few years. But how do we consciously flip the script? Because that's extremely difficult because you always have that little voice in the back of your head saying, you know, you're an imposter. You're not any good. how do you do that?
Well, let me give some background to this. What happened, uniquely for all of us, but pretty much universally, is that somewhere along the line in our early youth, we got a message, and the message was, who you are as you are is not enough to receive love. So what we began to do, whenever we got that message, whether it was people telling us, not explaining that our mistakes weren't an indictment of who we are, people not, loving us even when we did foul up, we owned that idea, who I am is not enough to receive love. And then we embarked on this fruitless journey of trying to be worthy by our outcomes. And that's another thing that our Western culture really seems to have as a given, is that who you are is based on your outcomes. Your value is based on what you produce, your results, your outcomes. You know, and we have whole huge seminars to help people get better results. And you know, there's nothing wrong with getting great results. But here's the deal. We bought a lie. No one's value is based entirely on their outcomes. No one's. But what happens is we buy into that, and then our outcomes are given excessive importance. And then when outcomes don't turn out, then we lash ourselves even deeper within. We feel even less good about ourselves, less lovable. And so we get on this treadmill of trying to get everything in place in our life so we can believe in ourselves and feel like others approve of us as well. And it's a futile thing. So here's what we do about that syndrome, which is, by the way, sadly and deeply at work in so many lives, so many lives. First of all, what I suggest in the book is that we have to open our hearts. Now, that sounds like just a virtuous, wonderful thing to do, but what's the power in that? The power is that this universe is really love in action. Now, we think of it just as we perceive it at a material, harsh level, an intellectual level, but at a deeper level, everything is coming out of an invisible field of love. And every one of us is loved beyond measure. Now, a lot of traditional religion goes out and tells people that they're originally sinful, which is not what Jesus ever came around to say. That was invented in the second and third century by theologians and Augustine as well. The truth is that we're precious beings. We're original blessings brought forth out of love. And we're here to actually give love. But we have to start first by opening our hearts to ourselves. Now, I write in my book about how in a wounding, a terrible betrayal, that I actually discovered that it really wasn't about the lady who dumped me, that it was about the fact that I had, in my early 30s, a closed and protected heart. She couldn't get in. I wouldn't let her be vulnerable. I controlled the relationship, and I was nice enough to her and all that. But she wanted a deeper connection, and she couldn't get it there. And finally, I owned that and realized that the huge transformation for my life would be to open my heart, to really access a love that is right within my heart. And I got to tell you, Jim, what happened when I did that was everything shifted to a whole new level. All of a sudden, what I valued and why I was doing things in my life shifted. No longer was I trying to do everything just to gain that approval that an injured child always wants. You know, I began to seek to just be me and have a good time. And here's the deal. You know, the most powerful people in the world are the people who are fundamentally, intrinsically happy and joyously. Mm-hmm. In other words, they're powerful because they aren't susceptible to being conned by all of the businesses and programs out there, countless ones dangling the carrot. If you buy our product, if you do this and that, then you'll be happy finally. And in people, if they haven't discovered their inner joy, they succumb to that. Deep inner joy through the open heart creates a natural kind of independence, self-reliance, and a willingness to get up and dust ourselves off when our results aren't what we want them to be, or we make a mistake. We realize that we're not here to be mistake-free. You know, we're here to learn and grow. And life shifts in every way. And you know what? We talked earlier about how we are attracting into our lives what's within us. When I opened my heart, all of a sudden my struggle to get people to love me, whom I had earlier secretly tried to control, all of a sudden people came into my life because because they could sense the love that was now happening in me. So I write extensively about that in the book, Jim, and also how this process of opening the heart can transform all of the toughest situations in life, like change, disease, fear, uncertainties, conflicts, how everything shifts, and those things shift from being things that pull us under to transformational opportunities. So that, in a nutshell, is what I think we're called to do.
I'm going to quote that great philosopher, Ricky Nelson. Garden party.
Good one, yeah.
Garden party, and there's a line in there. And I think as I get older, I understand it on one level, and I'll just add a little to it. You can't please everyone, so you've got to please yourself. Now, in other words, I don't think that, and I don't know really what he meant by that, other than he wanted to play the kind of music he wanted to play, and he was getting some pushback. But the thing is that I think that it's, you have to be comfortable with yourself and accept yourself. I mean, I could say in the last 5 years, I finally accepted the person I am. It's like, can I improve? Can I do better? Whether that's professionally, whether that's spiritually, whether that's personally. Yes, I can improve. There's room for improvement. I should try to improve. But fundamentally, I'm kind of the person I am. And I think I'm a pretty good guy. Again, with room for improvement. But I've kind of said, you know, I'm not, you know, 6'2" and, you know, a bodybuilder. That's just not who I am. And that's not who I'm going to be. So I've learned to accept myself. And also I've understood that it doesn't matter what you do. You're not going to please everybody. So you do your best to be in my view, this, I'm not saying this is what you're saying. You try to be a good person. You try to treat people well and ethically. But in the end, you know, let's say, for example, somebody's family is pushing them to be a doctor. They're coming out of high school and you need to go to med. You know, that person has, well, it depends on if you believe in reincarnation or not. But anyway, this person has this life. And it is their life, and this is the shot that they get at it, and they should pursue what they want to do. And if they want to go be a stuntman or a lawyer or whatever it is, they should, within reason, they should pursue it and not let other people impose their will upon them. And I think this thing of it's so important to accept yourself and then understand that you ultimately have to make that call because you're the one that's going to live with the consequences.
Yes, right. And we are willing to do that when we have decided that who we are is valuable in the first place, not because we succeed, not because we fulfill what other people think is high status or importance, but because it resonates with our hearts. You see, I think that's one of the real toxins of our society is that and we see it playing out in these election times, is sadly enough, in many ways, we become a heartless society. We can't even have civil discourse anymore because our hearts are closed, and we're haranguing at each other, and we're polarized. This is not the highest capacity for humankind. And, you know, I have a phrase that I tell my people here. Is that the work we're doing spiritually, we're not about changing the world. We're about championing an emerging world. I really feel like humankind is creating such severe problems on this planet out of an old paradigm of thinking and an old self-concept. So these problems aren't all bad. They have the capacity, if we let them, they have the capacity to birth a higher way of being in humanity. And if we can't do that, then our future is really questionable. So humanity is learning the hard lesson that the leadership of our lives should not be from the intellect. The leadership of our lives should be from the heart, using the intellect as a tool, a very powerful tool. There's nothing wrong with the intellect. It's just not meant to be the leadership of anyone's life or of humanity's life in general. And so we don't have a strong future if we can't begin to build bridges and love one another and start to live a different way, having heart for our environment, having heart for our young people. There shouldn't be a child on this planet that is hungry. And it should trouble every heart that's open that there are, even in our own country. So I see a crisis, not so much of just the environment. Those are like the the little bits of the sumac plant that are at the surface, but you go way down deep, it's that humanity is not centered in its heart. And that may sound just like a frivolous philosophical thing, but it's a real energy that's in our hearts. I know it because I opened to it, and it transformed my life. I believe we have the capacity, the creativity, the ingenuity as humans to solve any and every problem on the planet, but it'll never happen until there's a grassroots upwelling of healing heart.
You talked about politics, so I'll ask this as kind of a practical matter. Let's say there's someone in your life and you're on one side of the political spectrum. They're on the other side. You want to reach out to them as a person and maybe kind of agree to disagree, but they won't engage in a discussion. It's just name calling and those kind of things. I mean, how do you deal with people like this? And you could be on the left talking to somebody from the right. You could be on the right talking to somebody from the left. I firmly see this going both ways. I don't think it's a one-way road these days. So what would you suggest in those kind of, I mean, how to, as a practical matter, how do you break those kind of barriers down when you have people that mainly think, oh, you're in that camp, so therefore you're evil, on both sides? I mean, how do we start to break that down?
You know, politics is the wrong conversation. politics is a symptom of the shadow side of humanity right now. The real conversation is, how can we connect? How can we open our hearts and step out of our agendas and our opinions long enough to remember that the being next to me is a being of light? The being before me is a miracle. The being before me also has hurts and sufferings. And the being before me has a story to tell me. So I'm going to stop haranguing around political stuff and be available to listen, to connect. Let me tell you of a story. I was co-facilitating a conference in 2004 mm-hmm. of world religious leaders, and we met for the first 3 days. We have done this 3 times, by the way. We met for the first 3 days and looked at the problems of humanity and on the earth. And then on the fourth day, His Holiness the Dalai Lama arrived, and we would report into the Dalai Lama and get his input, and we would take the conversation to a new and higher level. That was the design of the conference. Well, on the very first day of this conference, a young lady, a Muslim journalist residing in Canada, encountered a very young, passionate rabbi from Israel. They met on the steps, and immediately the sparks flew. The accusations flew, the rancor. And we who were facilitating got word of this and intervened on the conversation and said, you know what, doing this on the steps of this facility isn't where we want to do this. Let's bring this into our opening session of what we called then our synthesis dialogues, seeking to synthesize something higher. So we did that. The next day, we after introductions and formalities, we brought them before us, and they started their conversation. It went right to that same place, the rancor, the anger, the accusations, you did this, and then inevitably the other person had something else. Yeah, but we did this because you did this, and it just went on and on. We spent the whole first day listening to that, and all of us just seeking to hold the space for them, hoping maybe they could arrive at something. The next day, they started in the same place, and it was getting more and more toxic, until finally one of us facilitating just intervened and said, would you speak to one another about your pain, about what has hurt you so much in this ongoing conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis? And so they spoke to each other about that. And their enormous discovery was that their pain was identical. Now, of course, they could have said it's because of this and that, but we didn't let them do that. They just connected with their pain was identical. Then the facilitator asked them, what is your vision? What are your dreams for yourself, for your children, for your future generations? And they shared those dreams, and they were basically identical.
Mm-hmm.
This was so profound to the two of them that after that sharing, they were in each other's arms, embracing each other, tears flowing. It was as though their hearts connected and all the other stuff, their agenda, their bitternesses dissolved. They became inseparable through the rest of the conference. They ate together, they talked together, they laughed together. Did they still have differing opinions? Absolutely.
Right.
Yet they were connected at some deep level. This is what I'm talking about.
Right. And I mean, it's a simple, I have a very dear friend who is, and I never talk about my political beliefs on the show because I don't want to alienate 50% of the audience. And because of this, because of this reason. And, I feel it, even though he's moved away and we've not been as in touch as we used to, just because of life circumstances, I would say he's been through my life, my best friend. And we couldn't disagree more on the political issues out there today. But the thing is that there's so many other levels that we connect and we kind of joke about it and we'll bring up a topic and say, well, you're full of it. No, you're full of it. and I think it's healthy.
Yeah.
And the thing is that there are so many other things that we connect on, whether it's like you said, your wants, your needs, the things that you want for your children, music that you love, entertainment that you love, spirituality, things that are important to you. There's so many other ways. And I think what's happened is we put up this roadblock between people of varying political beliefs. And then what I think you're describing is, okay, let's just kind of go around the side of that roadblock and connect that way and realize that block is still there. And we're going to still, you know, I love the old saying, agree to disagree. And I think that is something that our society has completely lost.
Well, we major in minors and we tend to forget what's essential. You and your friend have something that's more essential than your differing opinions. As many diverse people and cultures and practices on this planet, it's not about creating cookie-cutter cultures and everybody being stamped out the same, but it's learning that our hearts can connect over the bridge of our uniquenesses and our diversity, and that we can honor people and we don't have to see them as threats. Now, of course, if individuals are becoming violent and aggressive and creating trouble in that regard, we might have to hold that in check. But overall, we've got a crisis of heart in our world. We've lost track of that, and we've lost track then of the joy. You know, in my book, I write about how many great inventions have come forth when individuals were sort of peaceful and joyous and playful, and great ideas could show up. You know, we have the mental emotional airwaves are so full of toxins and discrimination and bigotries and accusations and all of this stuff. And we keep broadcasting fear and broadcasting violence and broadcasting all of this stuff that we in a way are putting a lid on our highest capacities. Our capacity for joy leads to our capacity for creativity, for forgiveness, for healing, for rebirthing. So, you know, we're in a crisis. But you see, I believe our crisis is really designed to be our birth, the birthing a higher order of consciousness in humankind. And we can do this, but we have to return to what's essential.
Now, here's one that's a tough one, and I'm sure you hear it all the time. You know, it's easy to be positive when you're in good health, your family's in good health, things are going well. But it's a lot harder to be positive and have a joyous outlook when maybe you're dealing with a dire illness, whether it's you or someone, or God forbid, you've lost somebody and somebody very close to you has died, maybe a spouse or a child. How can one access the joy when you're facing something like this, a life and death kind of situation?
Situations like those appear in different ways in every person's life. And yes, if you don't have a sense of inner strong joy going into those things, it becomes harder to find it in the midst of those kinds of painful experiences. But here's the deal. If we were to practice opening our hearts and accessing the joy that's already within us, we would realize that nothing on our human walk can actually take it away from us. Is a loss painful? Of course it is. I'm working with a lady right now who has previously done this work of opening her heart and is a very deeply joyous person. And she lost her husband in a course of 4 months. And he had just retired, and it was a total shock to her. And she's grieving deeply. And as I was talking to her the other day, she says, the tears are flowing. The tears are because I loved him so much. So they're beautiful in their own way. And I hurt. And there are times I'm okay, but I hurt. She said, but you know what? Life is still good. I still feel the joy. You see, the joy is a strong foundation for all of the passages of life we all go through, whether it's disease or pain or any kind of suffering. And what the joy provides is that while those are difficult, traumatic experiences, we don't lose our hope. We still have hope. And so really the way to move through these kinds of experiences that we will all have in one way at one time or another is to have that kind of deep connection with life and with love that gives us a joy that isn't entirely robbed. Are those difficult situations? Absolutely. But, you know, our situations don't create us. We respond to them in a certain way. And, yeah, it isn't as easy to be positive when things are tough, but it's still possible because those tough things aren't really controlling our emotions. They're not really controlling our thinking. We can take charge of that. And that's why I wrote this book, is to begin to give people the opportunity to strengthen. And hopefully, if they're in the midst of something, it'll help them realize that they're superior to their conditions, and they can create something new there. But it can also prepare people to have the inner resources that make it a whole lot easier to flow through these difficult times in life.
So if someone's listening and they say, I want to access this, but I don't know where to start. Where do they start?
Well, it might sound self-serving, but buy the book.
Yeah,
buy
I was going to say that.
Life is joy. But, you know, I also, throughout it, the chapters are arranged this way. There's first of all, the essence, and I talk about the principle. Then there's the experience, and I have countless examples of in my life and in many other people's lives of that principle. And then there's the third part of every chapter, the expression, and that's how you can put it to work, how you can express that principle. So it's very much a hands-on, here's a principle, here's how it has worked in many cases, and here's how you can work it. And then at the end of the book, there's a very in-depth heart-opening process that can assist people, because that's the greatest thing any of us can do, is so open our hearts that we can forgive ourselves, forgive others, begin to tap into the realization that life is good even as it is right now. And we begin to build up an inner power that then can transform everything in our life. I've seen it happen in countless lives, Jim, countless lives. I know anybody who's sincere about it and really willing to do the inner work, it will happen for them.
Well, I see here that you have a foreword by the late Wayne Dyer, and that's
dear
quite
friend.
That's quite a endorsement and a great man in his own right. It's powerful information. Where can people find the book This Life Is Joy?
That's pretty easy. Most booksellers, but Amazon is a great one. It's in hardback or paperback, and it's also available digitally.
Very
so on Kindles and things.
Excellent. Well, our guest has been Dr. Roger Teel. It's been a fun time, and we've talked about...
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. And we've talked about This Life is Joy, Discovering the Spiritual Laws to Live More Powerfully, Lovingly, and Happily. Thank you, Dr. Teel.
Anytime. Be glad to come back if you need me.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this edition of the Paranormal Podcast. I know that I did, and not to become a broken record, not to date myself, but please, if you enjoy the shows, wherever you may listen, please rate, review, and subscribe. Rate, review, and subscribe. Rate, review, and subscribe. I thank you so much. We'll talk to you next time on the Paranormal Podcast. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.
Now for the legal disclaimer.
We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.